The final chapter of the unit is about the reciprocal process compared to the one we were talking about in the previous chapter. We talked about the reciprocal relationship between the two. Last chapter was about the complete oxidation of glucose. This chapter is about the reciprocal process, which is photosynthesis. And photosynthesis is reciprocal to the complete oxidation of glucose because it undoes what the complete oxidation of glucose does, and vice versa. So complete oxidation of glucose undoes photosynthesis for the same reason. Each of them feeds the other. Photosynthesis is associated in most people's minds with plants, and I don't want to say anything bad about plants. They are major photosynthetic organisms. We absolutely need them. I just don't want you to get the idea that plants are the only photosynthetic organisms. Not only is that not true, but plants did not invent photosynthesis. Like all major biochemical pathways, it was invented first, long before eukaryotes even existed. In other words, prokaryotes invented photosynthesis evolutionarily long ago, billions of years ago. Plants have only existed for about 600 million years. So it's old stuff, but plants are the huge, conspicuous organisms nowadays that do photosynthesis. At the same time, though, you have others doing that, including a bunch of different kinds of algae. Algae, which is the plural of alga. An alga is kind of an informal name. It's not really a taxonomic group. It's just algae as a group refers to any protist that is photosynthetic, whether it's unicellular or multicellular. Remember that a protist is any eukaryotic organism that's not an animal, plant, or a fungus. So if you get rid of those, and then you pare it down even further, the protist, to just the ones that are photosynthetic, because not all protists are, then those are algae. And some of them are huge, like bigger than trees, brown algae, for instance. Some of them are unicellular, like this alga right here. But then you also still, importantly, have photosynthetic prokaryotes, the ones that started the whole thing, but they're really important still. They do things a little bit differently from what we are going to study the details of, which is how it's done in plants. That's what we're going to focus on in this chapter. But it's not really hugely different. One thing, though, that you should realize, if you thought about it, you should realize this right now, is that prokaryotes, the inventors of photosynthesis, do not perform their photosynthesis in chloroplasts, right? Because they don't have chloroplasts. Prokaryotes, by definition, don't have any membrane-bounded organelles. Chloroplasts, remember, started out as photosynthetic prokaryotes that got engulfed and survived that process. So they do, they meaning prokaryotic photosynthesizers, perform their photosynthesis with the only membrane they have, which is their plasma membrane. Otherwise, it happens pretty much the same as it would in a eukaryote within a chloroplast, the organelle, the eukaryotic organelle of photosynthesis. So let's take a look at a plant in slide 2. Now, plants are, there's a huge variety of plants, obviously. Not everyone's going to have leaves that look like this, or even leaves at all, for that matter. But on plants that have leaves, the leaves are usually, almost always, the most important photosynthetic organs of the plant. They have been adapted specifically to conduct photosynthesis, which is why the leaves on most plants are the greenest part of the plant. Now, around here, we see exceptions to that. Cacti have leaves that have taken on a totally different role evolutionarily. They've turned into spikes, which is for protection. And the green part of a cactus is the body of the plant, the stem. Whatever the case, wherever you see the greenness on a plant, that part, whether it's a leaf or not, that part of the plant is able to conduct photosynthesis. And that's because What makes it look green to us is that it has the photosynthetic pigment chlorophyll that we'll look more at in a minute, which is required for photosynthesis. But let's look at a leaf, which is typically the major photosynthetic organ of the plant. An individual leaf has kind of a sandwich arrangement to it, where the two pieces of bread are layers of cells, epithelial cells, just like our skin is, in between which something is sandwiched. The filling of the sandwich, whatever kind of sandwich you want to imagine it as, in a leaf is made of cells called mesophyll cells. Meso means middle, and phyll means leaf. So it's well named. It's the middle of the leaf, middle of the thickness of the leaf. The epidermal cells, the two pieces of bread, so to speak, are pretty waterproof. They're good seals. But, of course, they can't be perfect seals because photosynthesis requires gas exchange. You have to take in CO2, which is an input into photosynthesis. O2 comes out because it is a byproduct of photosynthesis. Remember, this is the reverse or the reciprocal process compared to the previous chapter. So this otherwise well-sealed epidermis on top and bottom is perforated, filled with holes here and there. Those holes are called stomata, which means mouth, or mouths, actually, it's a plural. One of them is called a stoma. Stomata are controllable, by the way. The stomata themselves are not structures. They're just the spaces, little holes. But the holes can open or close based on the action of two guard cells that have the gap between them. They can open them up or close them down. Anyway, the mesophyll cells are where you find the chloroplasts. That's why in this figure, the mesophyll cells are the only ones that are shown as green. These green things are the chloroplasts, which is why you didn't have to stain the plant cells when you looked at the leaves. They're already colored. You had to stain your own cells because they're pretty much transparent. All right, well, when we take a close-up look at a mesophyll cell, we can see that there's several different chloroplasts in it, and it varies greatly. There can be 20 or 100, roughly 50, let's say, chloroplasts within one mesophyll cell. And so that means there's many, many trillions in a big plant. But each individual chloroplast looks like this. We've looked at chloroplasts before. And just like a mitochondrion is doubly membrane-bounded, chloroplast also has multiple membranes, and for the same reason, by the way. They both have the same endosymbiotic origin, right? The mitochondrion was originally a bacterium that was capable of cellular respiration that got engulfed and survived. The first chloroplast was a photosynthetic bacterium that got engulfed and survived. And we eukaryotes have been allowing them to reproduce in our cells. Well, not we don't have photosynthesis, we don't have chloroplasts, but plants have both, chloroplasts and mitochondria. So let's just quickly remind ourselves of the anatomy. We've already talked about this. Since there are multiple membranes, there are multiple compartments. And technically, there's really two membranes, but they have three names. The outer membrane is just the smooth outer coating. The inner membrane is also smooth, but it's inside the inner membrane. And that really is the same as the membrane that's called the thylakoid membrane, but the inner membrane here and there folds into all this green stuff. So it's really continuous, kind of like the outer layer of the nuclear envelope is continuous with the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, even though they're different organelles. Okay, so this highly elaborate or folded membrane called the thylakoid membrane makes it look like it's a bunch of stacks of coins. And each coin-like structure is, even though it's not separate from the others, it's all continuous, is called a thylakoid. We're looking at a cutaway view. One stack of thylakoids is called a granum, the plural of which is grana. So there are several grana within one chloroplast, but it's all made up of the same membrane. And so compartmentally speaking, there is the compartment that's between the outer and inner membrane. That's just like in the mitochondrion, called the intermembrane space. There's a compartment that's inside the inner membrane, but outside all of these thylakoids. And that's called the stroma, which you should be careful with because it's only one letter away from stoma, which is also on a plant. Stoma is an opening. A stroma is a solution inside that compartment. And then when you have the compartment that's inside the coin-like structures, it's called the thylakoid space. That's where the stroma and the thylakoid space are where we're going to focus our attention, because that's where the chemistry of photosynthesis happens. Now to slide 3. Oh, you have a question?
No.
Okay. In slide 3, we're looking at a summary reaction. Before, we looked at the summary reaction of the complete oxidation of glucose, right? I told you that it doesn't happen in one step, even though the summary reaction makes it look like it does. It's okay. We're just summarizing a whole set of reactions by focusing on just the beginning and just the ending and ignoring the details in between when we write a summary reaction. Well, photosynthesis also has a summary reaction, and since it's the reciprocal of complete oxidation of glucose, the summary reaction is exactly the reverse. Now, there is one difference, though. That when I gave you the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, the inputs were the fuel, C6H12O6, plus you needed oxygen, and out came 6 carbon dioxide, completely spent fuel, plus 6 waters, and of course energy as the non-material output. This is exactly the reverse as long as you simplify it. CO2 and water, which were the outputs of this other one, are now the inputs. But notice it says 12 waters. However, the products are C6H12O6, 6 waters, and 6 oxygen. So if you simplify this, you just subtract 6 waters from both sides, and you don't have any here, and you have 6 up here, exactly the reverse. The reason they wrote it this way, though, with these arrows, is to show you where things end up in the end products. For instance, you might think that the oxygen that gets produced by photosynthesis comes from the carbon dioxide that comes in. But you can see here that it doesn't. The oxygen comes from the water that photosynthesis requires. And the oxygen of carbon dioxide ends up in water, in different water, I should say. But as far as the carbon-containing compounds are concerned, I also want you to think about the reciprocal relationship. Here we have 6 CO2s coming in. That's raw material. Inorganic stuff, right? That is really the truly important thing that photosynthesis accomplishes. What do we call that important thing that, as far as carbon is concerned, that photosynthesis does? Carbon fixation, which means taking carbon in an inorganic form and incorporating that into organic molecules. CO2 is inorganic, and the carbon that's in it is the raw material for making an organic compound, which is the sugar, C6H12O6. All right, which is exactly the reverse of what complete oxidation of glucose does, right? It takes that organic compound as a fuel and turns it into a completely spent fuel, which is inorganic CO2 as an output. All right, 4. Well, the reciprocal process, complete oxidation of glucose, remember, occurs in two different spaces. It starts out as glycolysis in the cytosol, and then cellular respiration, if it happens, happens in a different compartment, the mitochondrion, assuming we're talking about a eukaryote. That is not the same thing in photosynthesis. Photosynthesis doesn't start out in the cytosol. Photosynthesis occurs entirely within the chloroplast. Begins and ends in the chloroplast, which is why you see everything here in this summary within the chloroplast-shaped boundary here. Another thing you see here is that as the overall process, photosynthesis, it occurs as two major parts. There are two major components to photosynthesis, which in this slide are labeled the light reactions and the Calvin cycle. But I need to tell you there are multiple names for these. In old textbooks, you're probably unlikely to go back to the old-fashioned textbooks now and read them out of interest, but decades ago, the two parts of photosynthesis were called the light reactions and the dark reactions. You don't see those phrases anymore because when you call the second part the dark reactions, it kind of implies that darkness is required, and it's not. So they've replaced those names, light and dark reactions, with the light-dependent reactions, which this book doesn't use but is better. Light-dependent reactions, meaning light is required, and the light-independent reactions, meaning light's not required. If it's there, fine, it'll still happen. If it's not, it will still happen. Okay? So the two major parts are the light-dependent reactions, the light-independent reactions. But just like the citric acid cycle has an eponym name, an eponymous name, the Krebs cycle, named after someone, so does the light-independent reactions, which is why they can be called the Calvin cycle. All right, now these two parts of photosynthesis do very different things. Not surprisingly, they do different things, but it's very different. If you think about the goal, last time we talked about the goal of, in the previous chapter, the goal was production of ATP, right? Here the goal is production of organic compounds. The plant or other photosynthetic organism is making sugar not only for the purpose of feeding itself. Sugar is food for the photosynthetic organism, just like it is for us, which is why we eat plants. But that's not the only reason it's making carbohydrate. It's making carbohydrate because once you have carbohydrate, you have organic compounds to work with. You could burn it as energy, that's one use. But you could also then, now that it's in organic form, rearrange it into other organic compounds, like amino acids and all kinds of other things to build stuff with. Anyway, the goal, overall goal of this whole process is carbohydrates. And as you see here, that's performed in the second part. That's when the carbohydrates are actually built. But think about what's happening here. What are you using as raw material in this process? CO2. CO2, and you're building a hexose. What words would you use to describe that process? Catabolic. It's anabolic, exactly, not catabolic. The reverse process, which we just ended in the last chapter, was catabolic. You catabolize fuels because you break them down to release their energy. Here, it's anabolic as a process because you're building up a complex organic molecule out of simple inorganic molecules. And so, in terms of energetics, what word would you use to describe that? Endergonic, yes. Anabolic things are endergonic, right? Because it takes energy to build big, complex things out of small things. You release energy by deconstructing them. You have to spend energy to construct them. So the light independent reactions, the second part of photosynthesis, which is where the sugar is actually built out of CO2, cannot happen unless there is an energy source to drive that building. Well, you probably can guess, if you don't already know, that the energy source is light, right? But not directly. Plants can't directly use light energy to drive the building of carbohydrates out of CO2. If they could, they wouldn't need the first part of photosynthesis. Now think of this by analogy, or I mean by comparison with last chapter. I told you that cells can't directly use the energy released from fuels to drive their anabolic processes, right? And instead you need an energetic middleman, which is ATP. That's why we build ATP molecules and then immediately spend those ATPs to drive the endergonic processes. Same thing's happening here. Very similar thing. Calvin cycle or light independent reactions requires energy, but it's not directly light energy. It's from light energy, but not in the form of light anymore. Light has to be transduced into a different form of energy, energy that's usable for the light independent reactions. And what you can see here is that there are two forms of energy that are required for the light independent reactions, two forms of chemical energy. The Calvin cycle requires energy in the form of reduced coenzymes, and it's very similar to the ones we've already talked about, except there's a phosphate here. In photosynthesis, it's not NADH that's the reduced coenzyme, it's NADPH. This is yet another version of a taxi. It's a different company, does the same job, but and it still has two forms, but instead of it being NAD and NADH, it's NADP and NADPH. Okay? But anyway, that's one kind of chemical energy that the Calvin cycle requires. The other is ATP, which we're used to working with already. It's not either or, it's both. It has to have both. And it shouldn't surprise you, since we've already been through the previous chapter, that when these energy sources are used by the Calvin cycle, they get spent, in other words, that's going to leave you with ADP, because it gets dephosphorylated to spend it, and it's going to end up, and you're going to end up with the oxidized form of this new kind of taxi. NADPH is going to get turned into NADP plus, okay, and H plus, even though it's not shown there. Right, so that's the spent. Those are the empty taxis coming out of the second part. The whole reason the light-dependent reactions, the first part, are there is to provide the light-independent reactions, the second part, with both of those two forms of chemical energy that the second part requires. That's where the light is used. The light-dependent reactions are called that because they can't happen without light. Light is the original energy. Light is the original energy in everything you eat, right? Because some photosynthetic organism made the organic compounds that either you directly ate or that something you ate. It all comes from light. We're not here without the sun. But light is energy in a certain form, and it's not usable to the second part of photosynthesis. So the first part, the light-dependent reactions, needs to transform the light energy into chemical energy in the forms of NADPH and ATP. Well, doing that requires an input of water. So on the top of this, see that the two parts have different requirements. CO2 is a requirement for the light independent reactions. Water is a requirement for the light-dependent reactions. Those two together, though, are the inputs into photosynthesis. This is the reverse of photosynthesis. Okay? So you read this backwards, it's photosynthesis. And the output of the light reactions, or the light-dependent reactions, is water. So the water that you have to, is oxygen, I'm sorry. The water that you give a plant is a source of hydrogen atoms. It's not just to keep it moist. The water is a chemical requirement for the first part of photosynthesis. And as we'll see, it's not really so much hydrogen per se that the plant's trying to get from the water. It's electrons from those hydrogens. Just like when we pick hydrogens off of our fuels in the reverse process, it's not because we want hydrogen, it's because we want the high energy electrons from those hydrogens. And this is similar. So electrons from the hydrogens of water get used in the light reactions. We'll look at the details of that in a minute. But that leaves oxygen. That's why oxygen is a byproduct, an output of photosynthesis. That's right. Now think about the reverse process. We strip our fuels of hydrogen, and those hydrogens, as electrons and protons, become passengers in taxis, right?
Yeah.
Exactly the same is happening here. Electrons and protons of the hydrogens of water become passengers in NADPH.
And then they get transferred over to the sugars.
Yes, exactly. Those become hydrogens in the sugar. That's why you have no hydrogen up here in CO2, but you do in sugar, carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. So that's how it's all related. So let's think about this explicitly in terms of inputs and outputs. The light-dependent reactions, it happens first, has as material inputs water, oxidized coenzyme, empty taxis, NADP+, lower energy nucleotides, ADP, and inorganic phosphate. And non-material input is light. Of course, you can't have this happen without the energy, but it's not non-material input. The material outputs are ATP, higher energy nucleotide, NADPH, reduced coenzyme, both energy sources required for the second part, and oxygen as a byproduct. The light-independent reactions have as material input CO2, the carbon source, the inorganic carbon source. You also have to have input reduced coenzymes, NADPH, and high-energy nucleotides, ATP. The outputs are spent ATP, in other words, ADP, an inorganic phosphate, oxidized coenzymes, NADP+, and the sugar itself, which is the goal. But this handing off back and forth of these energy-carrying molecules shown in the middle of this figure is really the interplay between these two parts, both of which have to happen for photosynthesis. Slide 5 is about light, and I talked about this a little bit in lab already. Light is electromagnetic energy, so-called because there's an electrical component and there's a magnetic component. We're not going to get deeply into that in this course. But electromagnetic energy has a duality of nature, which is also beyond the scope of this course, but just trust me that electromagnetic energy acts as both a wave, it has wave-like properties, and it also has particle-like properties. So you can draw it as a wave, and anything you can draw with a wave has a wavelength, which is simply the distance from one part of the wave to the same part in the next in the pattern. Crest to crest or trough to trough, it's going to be the same distance. That's a wavelength. Shorter wavelengths exist, longer wavelengths exist, but it's all electromagnetic energy. The particle-like nature refers to photons. Photons are individual packets of electromagnetic energy. They're not particles that have mass, like an electron or a proton, but they have particle-like nature. Okay, well, this is really mostly about the wave-like nature of electromagnetic energy, and there's a huge range of wavelengths from very long to very, very tiny. The very tiny end is at this left end, 10 to the negative fifth nanometers. That's much smaller than an atom. The smaller the wavelength, by the way, the more dangerous the electromagnetic radiation is. Gamma rays, thankfully, get filtered out by the atmosphere, and otherwise we would all be dead. Things get a little less dangerous, but still dangerous in the X-rays range. This is all light. It's just not, you know, what we typically call light is what light is visible to humans, but it's all the same stuff. The only thing that's different between these categories is the wavelength. And humans' eyes are such that only certain wavelengths will cause any reaction to occur, which will lead to a sensation of vision. The other light's hitting us, we just don't know it. X-rays are dangerous, that's why they cause cancer, but they're not as dangerous as gamma rays. Ultraviolet radiation is so-called because violet is the shortest wavelength that we're able to see. And shorter than that is above violet, which is what ultraviolet really means. Then you have the visible range, which is just a really tiny slice of the overall spectrum. This top width is called the electromagnetic spectrum. It's all light. Only this part is humanly visible. And so you have blue end going to the red end. 750 nanometers is about as long as we can see. And then you get into longer wavelengths, which become infrared, below red, invisible to us, but still the same stuff. And then microwaves, like what cell phones are operating on, you know, those are going through your body all the time. You just can't sense them. Radio waves, same thing, much longer. All the same stuff. Well, we're in a chapter about plants, photosynthetic organisms, so why do I mention whether the stuff is humanly visible? It's because we've evolved similarly using similar, not identical, but similar pigments. Pigments are substances that are able to absorb photons of some wavelength. And that's why they appear colored to us. More about that in a little bit. But just so happens that the pigments that we animals use for vision are operating about the same part of the electromagnetic spectrum as photosynthetic pigments do. So the light that we can see is also the light that plants and other photosynthesizers can use for photosynthesis. So it's just a coincidence, really, why I'm talking about humans. But in 6, this cartoon of a chloroplast shows you that not all light gets absorbed by the chlorophyll, which is the pigment making this stuff look green to us. Chlorophyll is the photosynthetic pigment. So by definition of being a pigment, it absorbs light, which has to happen. Because if you're going to use light as energy source, which photosynthesis does, you have to absorb the photons of that light to receive the energy. Not all of that light that hits a plant, though, and hits the chloroplasts, gets absorbed. I told you in the lab that 3 possibilities exist, right? It can be transmitted. Some of it is being transmitted right here. It can be reflected, bounced away, or it can be absorbed. And only if it's absorbed can the plant use it for useful purposes to build sugars. If it gets transmitted or reflected, all it can do is maybe heat the plant up. It's not going to do anything as far as photosynthesis is concerned. And we tend to say that plants are green. Well, greenness is not a property of things out there in the environment. Greenness is an event. It's a process, a physiological process, a sensation in our brains. And it's not a property of the thing. Things don't have color. Color occurs in our mind. But it occurs, this greenness sensation occurs in response to light of a certain wavelength hitting our eyes. And so the reason we say plants are green is because when a plant is irradiated or light is shown on it, white light, which is the combination of all wavelengths, some of those wavelengths get absorbed. Those are the ones that are useful for the plant. And some of those photons of different wavelengths get reflected instead because the pigment can't absorb them well. Well, it's only the green wavelengths that get reflected, which is why the light that comes off of the plant looks like it's green light to us. The plant itself is not green. What this tells you, though, is that you would never want to give a plant just pure green light, because it wouldn't be able to absorb it, and it would starve itself, right? You wouldn't allow it to do photosynthesis. If you give it the red and the blue light, though, that's going to be able to allow photosynthesis to happen. This can be seen also in slide 7. The top graph is called an absorption spectrum. Well, each curve is. There are three different curves here at once in one graph. That's why it's using the plural, absorption spectra. But an absorption spectrum is a graph of absorption as the y-axis versus wavelength, which corresponds to us to color. Okay. Even though the light doesn't have color for the same reason the plant does, I'm just for simplicity going to call light different colors instead of saying wavelengths. The reason there are three traces here is because there's three major categories of photosynthetic pigments. Now, the chief photosynthetic pigment, as I've already said, is chlorophyll, spelled thus, which means green leaf. Chloro means green, just like in chlorine, a green gas. And phyll, as I've already told you, means leaf. But anyway, chlorophyll is the chief pigment, but there are two versions of it, chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B, so they each have their own trace here. And then there's a third category, collectively called accessory pigments. Carotenoids is a major one of the accessory pigments. Accessory pigments are also pigments, as the name says, but they don't absorb the same way that chlorophyll does, and neither does chlorophyll A compared to chlorophyll B. They all have different absorption spectra. And when you graph them to create these, you can see which colors are absorbed well and which ones aren't. Well, all of these peaks are occurring in one end or the other, the red and blue end, but not in the green, very low in the green. This shows you what I was talking about in the previous slide. Green light does not get absorbed, and therefore, when you put white light onto the plant, that's all colors, only one color comes back to us. The green. An action spectrum below that corresponds to the absorption spectrum, but this is just generated a different way. It's the rate of photosynthesis versus wavelength. So you can subject plants to different wavelengths of light. Like I said, you wouldn't want to give it pure green, because that's this part right here, very low amount of photosynthesis. You give it red or green, though, it peaks out. And finally, the bottom, which is an experiment to show this a different way. In this one, they had a glass slide, but it was in a sealed chamber, so it wasn't exposed to the atmosphere. And in that slide, they had a living alga. These cells are part of an alga, photosynthetic protist. And bacteria are growing on the alga. The bacteria are aerobic, meaning they require oxygen to live. And since this is a sealed chamber, the only place they can get oxygen is from the oxygen released by photosynthesis of the algae. And notice that the bacteria are not building up here where it's exposed to green light, because it can't absorb the alga can't absorb the green light and can't produce oxygen from photosynthesis. So they all correspond to each other. Back to chlorophyll, though, slide 8. This is one chlorophyll molecule. Now, should I require you to memorize this structural formula?
I don't think so.
What's the vote?
No.
Now, you don't have to know the structural formula, but I want you to appreciate a couple things about the overall structural formula. The magnesium is very, very important in its operation, and that's in the green part, which is the head of this thing. As far as absorption of light is concerned, the green part of the chlorophyll, because all this stuff is part of the same molecule. The green part, though, is the business end of the molecule, because that's the part that can absorb a photon, if it happens to be the right wavelength.
Magnesium.
The magnesium containing part of it can. And I told you before that there are two versions of chlorophyll, A and B. They are so similar to each other, importantly different in how they absorb, but they're so similar to each other that they have this entire structural formula in common, except this one part, this functional group. CH3 if it's chlorophyll A, CHO if it's chlorophyll B. That's the only difference. But it affects how they absorb. Anyway, the green part is, in a sense, the antenna of the molecule, because that's where the photon gets absorbed, if it's the right kind of photon. The tail down here has some carbons in it, but eventually it has a bunch of carbons in it, but it has some carbons listed as C's. Then eventually you get to this part and there aren't any letters. Well, all of this is just biochemical shorthand. When you see these shapes, every time you have a corner, a bend, and it's not labeled explicit with a letter, like O or C or H, then we assume that's a carbon. That's just shorthand. So every one of these little bends, these things, is a carbon. And also, a single line is a single covalent bond, right? So this would be carbon, this would be carbon. Well, you should know that that can't be all there is, right? Carbon has a valence of 4. So part of the shorthand also is that if you have a carbon at a bend here and it's only making 2 bonds at the moment, it has to make 2 more bonds, so you have to assume 2 hydrogens are there as well. There's just so many carbons and hydrogens that biochemists eventually got sick of drawing them, and they said, let's just do this for short and assume it. So this whole thing, without any letters, reminds you of what? What's it look most closely like that we've studied?
Fatty acid tails?
Exactly. It looks like a fatty acid. the tail specifically of a fatty acid, which is the hydrocarbon part. And that's what this is. It's a hydrocarbon tail. Now that doesn't help out in the reception of the light. The photon doesn't get absorbed by this part. But the place in the chloroplast where this thing operates, where this molecule, this chlorophyll molecule and millions of others like it, have to be in place is in a membrane. And specifically, the thylakoid membrane, the membrane that folds up into those coin-like structures. Right? Well, that's why this thing is a hydrocarbon tail. Hydrocarbon tails are nonpolar, just like fatty acid tails are nonpolar in phospholipids that make up bilayers of membranes, right? In other words, this hydrocarbon tail part has no problem at all being right next door to the hydrocarbon tail of a fatty acid that's part of a phospholipid in the bilayer that makes up the thylakoid membrane. And it will keep this molecule in there, bound to the membrane. Not by covalent bonds, just like proteins are not bonded to the phospholipids. They're kept in there, basically floating, because they don't want to be exposed to polar things. Right? Remember that picture I showed you in a different chapter when we were talking about transport proteins? If you tried to push the transport protein out or in, it would resist it because you would expose the the nonpolar part to polar heads of the phospholipid. That's the same thing happening here. This is what keeps it embedded in the membrane, keeps the chlorophyll molecule embedded in the membrane. But the green part is the place where the photons get absorbed. And in 9, I'm not going to go past 9. That's kind of a natural break in topics. So I think I'll just stop it there. We can finish next time.
All right.
Good place to stop for the week.